Welcome to SCOTUSCast, RFRA and the Contraceptive Mandate Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 23, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Zubik v. Burwell, the lead case in a consolidated series, with the other petitioners including Priests for Life, Southern Nazarene University, Geneva College, Roman Catholic Archbishop of Washington, East Texas Baptist University, and Little Sisters of the Poor Home for the Aged. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010 requires that group health plans and health insurance issuers provide coverage for women's preventative care or face financial penalties. Although the ACA does not define preventative care, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, relying on the Institute of Medicine, determined that the term encompassed, among other things, all FDA-approved contraceptive methods, including drugs and devices that could induce an abortion. Although the government exempted religious employers from this mandate, the exemption was narrowly defined and did not extend to petitioners. The government did, however, offer nonprofit entities such as petitioners an accommodation. Under the accommodation, which was modified in the course of litigation, an objecting religious nonprofit entity complies if it provides the government with a notice that includes the name of the eligible organization, its plan name and type, and the name and contact information for any of the plan's third-party administrators and health insurance issuers. Upon receiving the notice, the government notifies the objecting entity insurance company, or TPA, which then must provide payments for the requisite contraceptive products and services. A number of objecting nonprofits sought relief in various federal courts, arguing that the accommodation violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. The resulting litigation produced a series of fractured opinions and a split in the Court of Appeals, with nonprofit religious organizations prevailing in the Eighth Circuit but losing in a number of others. After imposing a brief injunction on enforcement against petitioners while it considered various petitions for certiorari, the U.S. Supreme Court granted a number of petitions and consolidated the cases for oral arguments on the following question: whether the HHS mandate and its accommodation violate RFRA by forcing religious nonprofits to act in violation of their sincerely held religious beliefs, when the government has not proven that this compulsion is the least restrictive means of advancing any compelling interest. On March 29th, the court also issued a detailed order requiring the parties to brief whether and how contraceptive coverage may be obtained by petitioners' employees through petitioners' insurance companies, but in a way that does not require any involvement of petitioners beyond their own decision to provide health insurance without contraceptive coverage to their employees. To discuss the case, we have Roger Severino, who is director of the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Severino.
First contrast, I was at the Hellerstedt oral argument, and the feeling in the court and outside was very tense. This was very different. You had a bunch of nuns outside the court singing hymns, and it just kind of changed the tenor of the whole day. I don't know if some of that bled into the courtroom, but it just did feel different. And another notable thing is that Justice Scalia's seat doesn't have the black cloth over it. His seat has been removed, and they've reshuffled the justices and their seating arrangement. So it was kind of poignant to see that, you know, Justice Scalia, the stalwart of conservatism, you know, is not there to argue this very big case when he was part of the 5-4 majority in Hobby Lobby. A bit about the background on the case itself. This is about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and one of its mandates. So the law that Congress passed required that preventative services be covered, but it didn't specify what counted as preventative services. Through regulatory rulemaking, a third party determined that preventative services would require coverage of contraceptives, of abortion-inducing drugs that work to induce abortions, like Plan B, like Ella, and also to cover sterilization. And it had to be covered without a copay, the argument being that if you have no copay, you'll end up saving money for the insurers, because you will avoid and delay pregnancy, which could get expensive. So that's how it was sold, and it was done through regulatory rulemaking. And as you might imagine, because it dealt with issues so sensitive to life, many religious employers objected, and they objected at the rulemaking phase. And also, as the cases started to wind out after the rules were finalized, there was an exemption offered by the administration, which covered churches and integrated auxiliaries based on a provision of the IRS code. And there was another couple very big exemptions. One was an exemption for small businesses under 50 employees. And then there was an exemption for grandfathered plans. This was based on the, if you like your insurance, you could keep it. So corporations that did not change their plans were able to keep it without having to cover contraceptives and Plan B and other objectionable drugs. This included Exxon, Chevron, and Pepsi. So in sum total, about one out of three Americans were not covered by this contraceptive mandate. Religious institutions, however, some of them were covered. The ones that didn't cover as a church or an integrated auxiliary, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, they're not an integrated order under a bishop, so they actually would not qualify as being religious enough under this exemption. They objected to it, and in the meanwhile, Hobby Lobby was objecting as well. So this was the for-profit, closely held business that did not want to provide the set of these drugs under their plans for their employees. That case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. In a 5-4 decision under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the court held that it did impose a substantial burden on the religious beliefs of the owners and operators of Hobby Lobby. And interestingly, one of the deciding factors was that they pointed to an alternative enforcement mechanism that the administration had promulgated for religious nonprofits. So it said if you could provide an alternative mechanism for this group, why didn't you at least offer that to Hobby Lobby to see if it would have got rid of the substantial burden? However, it withheld the question as to whether or not that proposal itself could impose a substantial burden on those religious nonprofits. So it was very interesting. It said you're providing an exemption, at least offer it more broadly, but we don't know if that exemption is going to be good enough ultimately. And that's where things stayed until the Little Sisters of the Poor and various other religious groups objected, and their cases wound up on this alternative mechanism. The mechanism is, the administration calls it an accommodation, and they say it does so because the religious nonprofit is not required to directly pay for the objectionable drugs and devices. So they are required to submit a form, Form 700, identifying that they are an objecting institution, identifying their third-party administrator, their plan administrator, and giving them contact information so that it would authorize the government to then issue the contraceptives and drugs through a third party and require that third party to bear the costs. Now, money is fungible, and whether or not that actually means the religious institution is not paying for it indirectly or directly or not, that's not so much the issue anymore. The Little Sisters and the other petitioners argue it's not really about the money. It's about the complicity in the provision of these objectionable drugs and devices. So the argument that was actually raised by Paul Clement, who argued for Little Sisters, he said, imagine if the Little Sisters have an office and the government said, we're going to require you to dedicate some space in that office to open up a Title 10 clinic, which provides free contraceptives to your employees. And don't worry, we'll pay for the contraceptives, and we'll even pay you rent for that space. And that's the argument they said would violate their religious beliefs. That would impose a substantial burden, because even if they're not paying for it, they're still cooperating in that provision. They're still part of the mechanism, and this word was used multiple times, their infrastructure was being hijacked. So that was the framework that the petitioners were saying, this is a hijack. Now, why does this matter for the governing law? Well, the governing law is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was passed in the wake of the Employment Division versus Smith decision, which was a Scalia decision, in fact, which changed the test under the Free Exercise Clause. The test used to be essentially that if a substantial burden was imposed on people under the Free Exercise Clause, the government would have to justify that burden by compelling government interest using the least restrictive means possible, the familiar strict scrutiny test. Employment Division versus Smith said that's not going to be the case anymore. The test is shifted when there's a new actual law of general applicability and doesn't directly target a religious institution, et cetera, for disfavor like discrimination, then essentially rational basis applies, absent some unique circumstances or exceptions. And that was reacted to by Congress very harshly. They responded with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which restored the substantial burden test as a federal statute. It originally applied to the states. In Bernie, it limited it just to the federal government. And that's why this is at issue now, because these are federal laws and federal regulations. And so the substantial burden test is what is directly at play. So interestingly, Justice Kagan was saying, well, she rehashed the Smith argument. She said, isn't this going to just open up a can of worms where every religious objector will essentially be a law unto themselves, and they get to decide what they object to, and then the government will have to deal with an unending number of exemption requests, and they'd have to tailor them to every single one. To which the petitioners, I think it was Clement, who said, that's right, but that was what was decided after Smith, and Congress rejected the Smith test. So you could relitigate Smith, but it was already decided by Congress that they would not adopt the Smith test, and they would stick to the Sherbert versus Verner test that preceded it for substantial burden. Right out of the gate, so the liberals use the analogy that this is not really a substantial burden by analogizing to conscientious objectors, and this was Kagan and Sotomayor picked up on this. They argued that essentially petitioners are objecting to the process of objecting. So if you're a conscious objector in war, you're required at the very least to say, I don't want to fight. But what if that same objector said, I don't want to tell you I don't want to fight because I know that will trigger you finding somebody else to take my place? And to which Clement responded, that's not the case. Here, if you really want to have a correct analogy, it would be that the conscientious objector would be required by the government to point out the precise person who will take his or her place. And that's more akin to what the little sisters are required to do by filling out these forms, identifying their third-party administrator. And without that little form, which the government tried to say is just a form, no contraceptive coverage would flow to their employees. So the petitioners repeatedly said, if it's not that big a deal, then why are you requiring the little sisters to sign the form and identify their third-party administrator on pain of fines to the tune of $70 million. That's the substantial burden that the petitioners were talking about, that it is the fine of that extraordinary amount that really shows you how burdensome this is. If the government really didn't care about it, if it really had alternative mechanisms that it was more than willing to pursue, it wouldn't be punishing the little sisters for not complying. So that was on the substantial burden point. It surprisingly, on the lower courts, we had a lot of victories at the district court level for the religious institutions and a lot of losses at the appellate court level. But you still had a circuit split. I think it was Eighth Circuit ruled in favor of the religious institutions. So you had that split, and those circuit courts were ruling all on the issue of substantial burden. They all said that this does not impose a substantial burden on the religious nonprofits. This is a case of attenuation. So that word attenuation kept coming up in the lower courts, that there are too many steps removed from the actual provision of contraceptives. This is insurance, this is a third-party administrator, this is a regulatory scheme. And the second point they would make is that there's no burden because religious nonprofits just have the facts wrong. They are not the ones that are legally responsible for the flow of contraceptive coverage. It is actually the regulatory scheme that's responsible. It's the federal government that's responsible. To which Justice Kennedy responded, so you're saying that they're not complicit and don't worry about it? And he said that almost sarcastically. He very quickly, when he was questioning Solicitor General Verrilli, he questioned and he said, are you conceding that there's a substantial burden? And just right out of the gate, he took practically the substantial burden question off the table, and saying you can't really question their sincerity and you can't question their views of how this operates. And no matter what the government says about it, it is the religious institution's view of the matter that carries the day, to the extent that they are actually required to act. So they are actually, the Little Sisters of Poor and others, they're required to do something. It's not simply an instance where the government does an action and the petitioners object. The government is requiring the religious nonprofits to do something, and that's send a notice and notify them of their plan administrator and give information, and that is what triggers all sorts of flow of objectionable devices. So it really seemed as if Justice Kennedy was not having it. He was not. It didn't seem like he was willing to entertain the substantial burden question. And again, this is where all the action was at the lower courts. But most of the action before the Supreme Court was on the secondary questions. So once you get through a substantial burden, so you establish a substantial burden on the religious exercise under RFRA, then the question moves, can the government prove that it had a compelling governmental interest that was enforced in the least restrictive means possible? And there was much discussion as to whether or not there was a compelling governmental interest. As I mentioned earlier, churches and integrated auxiliaries were exempt. Small businesses under 50 were exempt. Grandfathered plans were exempt. That's one out of three people in the country were not covered by the contraceptive mandate. There was a lot of back and forth on this very point as to how you can have so many exemptions yet still say you have a compelling governmental interest. And the chief, he actually made it a more precise point. He said the compelling government interest can't be that it's the provision of contraceptives generally. It is the compelling interest in providing contraceptives through the plans of these religious nonprofits. That's really what it comes down to. And pointing out to the fact that there are all sorts of alternatives that could have been pursued. Petitioners are very clear. Noel Francisco also argued for petitioners in saying that if the government has all sorts of exemptions and it says that it could fulfill its compelling governmental interest in providing free contraceptives to all sorts of people that are exempt, why not do that same mechanism, that same plan, whatever the government's doing there, do it for us? Why are you picking on us? Why are we special? Why are we different? Why is it that you need these religious nonprofits to fulfill this interest when you're finding a way to fulfill this interest somehow for the big corporations, for the church plans, and for the small businesses that are exempt? The counters were virulently said, well, we had grandfathering for the ADA, and we had exemptions under Title VII for discrimination. Small businesses are exempt from that. So you could actually have exemptions, and that doesn't undermine your compelling governmental interest. And Breyer picked up on this and said, well, the tax code is chock full of exemptions, and that we don't say that the administration of the tax code is not a compelling governmental interest. And he was essentially saying, if we accept your argument, then we're going to get all sorts of tax protesters coming forward. Nobody mentioned that the Lee case should have handled that, unfortunately, but I think that does handle it. But in any event, that was the interplay on the level of exemptions and how they matter. Petitioners came back and they said, well, the exemptions matter very much. Even if you set aside the grandfathering and even if you set aside the business, you can't have a rational explanation for exempting only churches and integrated auxiliaries. Under an obscure IRS provision, HHS picked this as their dividing line when it has nothing to do with employee coverage. And in fact, if you qualify, you don't even have to object to contraceptive coverage. You automatically get an exemption in this narrow band. And the question is, why would you exempt the archdiocese and Catholic Charities under there, but not an independent standing Catholic Charities, when they do essentially the same thing, when they're both entirely religious? The Little Sisters of the Poor are sisters, nuns, essentially. And it was very much a discussion as to why is it that you would pick only this one slice for exemption and favored treatment and not the other? On the least restrictive means, we had the question of, why is it that you're requiring this program pass through this order of nuns in this particular way when you could put people on the exchanges? So there's a significant discussion on why the exchanges are viable from the petitioner side and why the exchanges are not viable coming from the opposers. So on the point of the exchanges, Sotomayor seemed, and Ginsburg to another degree, seemed to say, well, why are you going to force women to do this alternative mechanism when the whole point of it is to make it easily flow? And Verrilli said, this is supposed to be seamless coverage. And that's the entire point. If you require women to go through an extra step and go on the exchanges, it's just a regulatory hassle. And the very reason they're requiring the religious nonprofits to take part in this mechanism is to overcome inertia. And that's essentially what we're saying. That's a compelling government interest, to overcome inertia, because benefits will not take advantage of it otherwise. And if you're creating an obstacle by making them go to the exchanges, then you're defeating the very purpose of requiring the coverage to go through this alternative mechanism. And Alito very quickly pointed out, well, are you saying that the exchanges are unworkable, which got a laugh. It was essentially hearkening back to all the glitches and errors with the rollout of the Obamacare exchanges. So that got a few chuckles. And Alito followed up by saying, well, you argue that you have all sorts of restrictions that prevent you from doing an alternate mechanism for providing free contraceptive coverage. And Alito said, isn't it not within the executive power to waive the penalties for noncompliance if somebody violates one of these regulations and they provide the contraceptive coverage anyway? And that was essentially an allusion to the government's view, that the broad view of executive power in, for example, the immigration context. If you're willing to stop enforcement of laws in that context, Alito was essentially saying, why aren't you willing to stop enforcement in this context, if it were useful in the flow of free contraceptives without requiring the Little Sisters and their cooperation? And finally, I'll end with how it was closed. Clement has a very good rebuttal. He raised the point that Title VII was a much better dividing line for what counts as a religious institution, and the obscure tax provision certainly was not. He cited the Mary Mother of the Eucharist brief on that point. And then he closed by saying that this is not about conscientious objection. It is about conscientious collaboration. And I think that encapsulated the arguments quite well. It is about forced collaboration in a scheme that people of good conscience, goodwill, and religious faith cannot agree to. And if they do, if they don't, they'll be fined to the tune of $70 million.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.